Welcome back, everyone, to Citywide Blackout, your home for music, movies, and more. My name is Max Bone. I am the host of the show. And joining me now, well, we are talking about one of my favorite things in the world, that is comics. I am talking to two of the minds behind the Afterlift series, which you can get on Comixology. I'm talking to Chip Zdarsky, the writer, Jason Liu, the artist. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. It is awesome to have you here.
Cool. Thanks for having us.
No problem. I just want to say, first off, to the people listening at home and to you guys, this is an absolutely amazing title. Check it out right now. I've read it twice, loved it both times. I just like tore through it, basically.
Oh, awesome.
I just like,
thank you.
Because like the thing is, it kept on coming up on my recommendations list. So like, okay, I'll just check it out. Okay. And take a look. See, it's like, okay, love the art. This is really cool. Rideshare to Hell. I like the idea. Fewer pages. Okay, I'm digging the concept.
Did it have like the sponsored or promotional tab right beside that recommendation?
Yeah. Absolutely loved it. It's such a different kind of title.
Thank you.
I'm curious as to where the concept for doing this kind of so to give people some background, I should probably give you guys some context. This story focuses on Janice Chen, who has quit her day job to basically be the equivalent of an Uber driver. And one day she picks up a fare who is a demon transporting a deceased soul to hell. And it just goes from there. It's a great concept. Yeah. Where did the idea come from for this, though? Tell me it's not based on actual rideshare rides, okay? Please.
No, I mean, for some reason, I got stuck on the idea of the River Styx. And that kind of the ancient idea of paying the ferryman to cross over into the afterlife. And that really stuck with me. And I kept thinking, like, well, what's the modern equivalent of it? And I landed on like Lyft or Uber or one of those. So that was kind of the entry point. And then once I kind of had the, I don't know, is that high concept or low concept? I can never tell what is high concept or low concept. People throw those terms around, but I don't know. Once I had that kind of concept, then it became, well, what kind of story do you want to tell with that idea? What kind of themes do you want to get into? And I've known Jason for 15 years. Oh my God, how old are we?
Since 2004. So yeah, 16 years.
Holy shit! Yeah, man.
I was like an intern.
I'm so old.
A college intern.
So that doesn't make you old. It makes me more old because you were our college intern. Yeah, because I had a studio with a bunch of other illustrators and comic artists here in Toronto, and we started taking interns, and Jason was one of them, and he was amazing even back then, and he just got better and better as he kind of went about and did his own projects, and we're both from Toronto and friends, and it seemed like a natural fit to bring him in for this story.
And the art, I think, was one of the things that just kind of like just caught me like immediately, because I'm kind of like a nerd for really good like comic art. The really good ones just like stick in my head every time. So, Jason, a question to you, man. What was the process for just sort of like developing the look for this series?
Ooh, well, it was definitely lots of training and practicing on drawing cards because that was so out of my comfort zone.
Yeah, I felt bad. Like, I knew Jason, like, he was able to draw street scenes because I'd seen them in his previous series, The Pitiful Human Lizard, which is awesome. But, like, once I realized this was going to be all cars and car chases, I was like, oh, fuck, I'm glad I'm not drawing that.
So, yeah, Chip approached me about, like, doing a comic project, and I was like, I was excited about the idea, but then, like, the catch was drawing cars, like, So that's a catch. All right, we'll have to
You got so good at it so quickly. Like Jason sent in like his first kind of sketches of like cars in motion. I'm like, oh, those are really good. And then like a few days later, he sent in more. He's like, I think I'm getting better at this. I'm like, holy fuck, yeah, you are.
and so
the artist. Yeah. As an artist myself, like I know how hard it is to draw cars. And also, I get so mad when I see an artist get so much better at something so quickly. Like, it benefits our comic, but it upsets me on a personal level. But Jason
was like not depending on a ruler at times. Like, I'm not really like a technical artist, so I was trying to like treat the cars as a character. So, yeah, like Genesis Carr was like a cast member in Afterlift. So,
yeah.
just trying to like make the car look a bit distorted during movement, which added certain liberties to like just, you know, wonky lines. That's how we got away with it.
Looks so good, like
now what about cars is so difficult to draw, like what's like the big challenge with that?
Getting the right angles. Especially like you don't want to get the wrong angles where like a Honda Civic could look like a Mazda 3. Like there are certain distinctions that you had I had to be conscious about. But yeah, it was definitely lots and lots and lots of practice. It took I had about like a month of just drawing cars before Chip gave me the script, and I was just trying to draw cars in different angles. I was looking at chase scenes in Fast and the Furious, and looking at samples of Initial D, and like just capturing their use of speed lines for the cars.
I like that you made it sound like I was withholding the script until you were ready. Really, I just hadn't written it yet. Like some like shitty karate movie. Like, no, only when you are ready will I teach you this one thing. Like, no, I just wasn't ready. I find cars really hard to draw because you think they're basic shapes, but when you actually look at a car, like it's. They aren't boxes. Like there's so many distinct curves and parts to them that I have an incredibly hard time drawing them. Yeah,
and you did like so many like kinds of cars too. You know, you didn't just do like one generic car. You did like old fashioned hot rods and roadsters and trucks and vans and everything. So you definitely your style kind of covered like any kind of car you can think of.
Oh yeah, the cars definitely had to reflect the driver themselves. Chip gave me some ideas of what he wanted for Janice's car, and like Janice, who in the comic she like worked at a law firm, or like she had like a career where she made lots of money before she got out of it and became an Uber driver or a Lyft driver. Well, I don't think you branded it.
Yeah, careful.
She's also got money from her grandmother's inheritance as well. So we wanted like a very sporty, expensive looking car, not too expensive like a Porsche, but somewhat domestic. So I think I modeled it after I think it was a Mazda. It was a Honda Civic. It was like a 2019 Honda Civic.
The other problem with drawing cars is the fact that, like, I know nothing about cars. I couldn't tell you the difference between, like, a Mazda, a Toyota, like, no clue. But you know the readers. There's always going to be readers that know the difference.
Oh, yeah.
So you don't want to screw it up. It's like if you're drawing Punisher and you, like, you know, just draw, like, an Uzi and they'll be like, well, actually, you know, that's not actually a weapon that he would use because it does this and it couldn't fire like that. Like, there's always people that know. You kind of have to become an expert in everything when you're a comic artist.
Yeah, because there's always someone out there.
Less the comic writer. I'll say, like comic writer, you have to study, obviously, specific things and history and cultures, but, like, the comic artist, like, that's the hard job because you really have to – everything in the scene has to feel legitimate.
Oh, yeah.
Like if you fake like a kettle on a stove, like it just takes people out of the story, you know?
Yeah. I think especially when you do something like draw a city, you've got to get that city exactly right. If you get anything wrong, you know there's going to be someone out there who's going to be like, actually, you know, that nightclub you drew on like 5th Street doesn't exist. It's actually on like Simonson Street or some crap like that. You're always going to get the nerd out there who's going to just pick those things apart.
Yeah, thankfully we had a generic city.
yeah. But it looked and felt real. Like, I find it when I'm doing comic shows and artists bring up portfolios to show me, the street scenes are usually too perfect. Like they're like if you actually look at a street, like there's like weird things jutting out and, you know, pipes coming out of walls and And then people tend to forget all that stuff when they go to draw, because they're just like, oh, this is a building and a sidewalk. But
yeah,
but cities aren't.
They forget,
you know,
like
their
the
characters.
Road signs and traffic lights.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The
yeah,
type exactly. of sidewalks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Little things. I think like one of the best comics when it comes to like accuracy for a city would be Wayward. They have like mostly set in Tokyo, and I guess the artist actually lives in Tokyo, so he knows the place like the back of his hand. So he caught.
I know. I just met him. I was in Tokyo in the fall. We met for the first time there, and he's like,
was it Trebrill?
Fluent in Japanese. What's that?
Was it Trebrill? Of Wayward?
No. Stephen Cumming.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He's like. He knows those streets backwards and forwards, and you can tell in that comic.
Yeah, because I think like in like a lot of cases, if someone does draw like New York City or Boston, they're going to focus on the city part. They won't focus on everything else. And I think that a really good city rendition is one that covers all the details.
Yeah, like I don't know. I mean, I know how they did it, but like the idea of being an artist without Google Street View, I don't know how people did it. Like, to assist in an illustration studio with a bunch of older illustrators, and they had filing cabinets just full of reference photos. Like, you'd be like, oh, okay, yeah, I need street scenes, and they'd have a file that says street scenes. You pull it out, it would just be photos they've taken, photos they cut out of magazines and newspapers, and that was the reference of the day.
We are spoiled.
It's crazy.
I remember like 16 really years are. Ago when I was an intern, I was like just taking photos and getting them developed, like photos mm-hmm. around Toronto and just using them for my comics.
I was the first of my artist friends to get a digital camera, and I was so proud of it and such a nerd that I actually had a holster for it. So I would walk around with like this. And I also was the first one to have a cell phone, so I had a holster on side with the phone and the holster on the other side with the camera, and I would constantly be taking that camera out and taking pictures of street scenes. Like, it just felt like it was unlimited because I didn't have to develop the pictures anymore. Yeah. Like, I could get actual accuracy of cars and buildings. Yeah. But now, I mean,
we all got
there's no excuse. Yeah, there's no excuse now for an artist to have a poorly drawn car or building. You can find a car online.
Yeah, exactly.
You can trace a car too.
Yeah. Jason, was there like a certain kind of car that was like trickier to draw than the others?
I guess it was one of the name of the car, but it's like a roadster car. Like, I want to say Thunderbird, but it's that the black like T-Bird car that one of the demons was riding, and it's easy to draw them very blocky and like rectangular, but you got to make sure you get those curves and those curvy contours that makes it authentic.
And you mentioned the demons. So as we mentioned before, this whole thing takes place mostly in hell. Yeah. I want to ask you how you got the idea for the general like look of the demons. Was this based on something else you had seen, mythology? Where did the concept come from? Because I just loved it.
Oh, thanks. Like, yeah, I definitely wanted to go for something completely different. Because, like, we've seen, like, the standard, like, two-horned demons, red face. I wanted to go for something different by being inspired by these Indonesian demon masks that I grew up staring at when... They're hung at my uncle and aunt's house, and like I've grown up like always like fascinated by them because they're like always staring at you, like on this wall, and it's like they have like all these like crooked tusks, bug eyes, and they're just colorful too, like just like not just red, but like there'll be like some like blue eyeshadows or like yellow teeth that we don't really
see. Did your uncle
Western demons?
Yeah, did your uncle like collect them, or was it a religious thing? Or
I think it's just one of the many artifacts that he has of Indonesian culture, which where I'm from.
It's always funny when religions people always hang up things that are just like terrifying aspects of a religion. like even Christ on the crucifix. I'm like, that's a horrific thing to hang in your house, but everyone does it.
Especially the more like detailed ones, like you see often in churches, that has like the full, like it's full sized. You can see like the pain on his face, the blood from the wounds. Thing that's depressing as crap.
Oh yeah, that's pretty graphic. But the neat thing about like the Indonesian demon masks are like they're very decorative. Like there's like some beadworks around them, some gold foils. So yeah, it's definitely just great articles of decoration for the house.
Nice.
Yeah.
Now, do they kind of know that their mask collection kind of inspired your demons?
Yeah.
Definitely my mom and dad have.
Yeah.
since they would be reading the articles about the comic, but I don't know. My cousin is actually like she inspired the look of Janice. So,
oh, cool.
And she's the daughter of the uncle that owns the death mask. So maybe she might have passed it along.
Ooh.
It's always weird when you reference family and the creation of a thing. Because I did that with when I started writing for Marvel, it was Howard the Duck. And people would ask me, you know, my history with the character. I'm like, oh, yeah, I have this like weird Uncle Fred. He's kind of this weird hippie. And he had like all these old black and white magazines. And I got into them. And so now every time I see my Uncle Fred at a family reunion, he's like, oh, here I am, weird Uncle Fred. I'm like, oh. Sorry, man.
But now he's also...
He takes it as a badge of pride.
Yeah, you go. Hey, he's famous, you know, and so's your niece. You know.
Yeah.
Was this your first time working together?
Yeah, I mean, besides just like...
the internship stuff, like I was like just doing like color flats for Chip's illustrations. There were like... book illustrations for like educational children's book.
Oh my god.
That deal with themes on like bullying and other social issues.
Yeah, those were a nightmare. Because before I did comics, I was doing freelance illustration, and I had a friend that worked at that publishing company, and these books came out so quickly. Like she would just like give them to us in the studio to work on. But it would be like 60, 70 illustrations per book. You have to do them in like 2-3 weeks. And so they're embarrassingly bad, like so bad. And I feel bad that I made you color flat them.
the funny thing is because I work at the children's department of a public library, and our collection still has those books.
Oh man! I must see these.
They're so terrible.
The is like, I remember some of these drawings.
I must see these books terrible. Now. I want to find them.
Well, I think that's this the is only thing I'll give There's... you.
There's this horrible thing with the book too. When we were working on it, because you draw them all so fast, and you know, you're very you always have in mind, especially because it's for kids and educational purposes, to really diversify the characters in the book. But we were about to send the book to press, and the editor got back to me. She's like, 5 to 10% of these kids need to have disabilities. So you have to do something. I'm like, what? So I just kind of went through the book, and I was just like basically maiming these children. I'd be like, oh, all of a sudden this kid, I'd add like a line here and a line there, like, oh, now that kid has a fake arm, and I'm like, oh, I'll give that kid like a hearing aid, I'll make that kid blind, give them a cane. Like, it's just, it was such a weird process to go through and just like choose these kids at random to be like, all right, okay, now you no longer have a leg.
Then off you go, children.
Yeah, it still haunts me to this day. I mean, it's the correct call, but I wish I knew it going in, and I could give it some thought of doing it after the fact.
And this is what it's like to play God. You're blind. You're crippled. You're deaf. You're missing a limb.
It was kind of heartbreaking.
Oh my god. And you just can't rush good art. I think it's simple as that. Which kind of, well, you can, well, you can try at least, but it doesn't always work out.
Yeah, you think, nah, but Jason's the fastest artist I've ever worked with.
Oh, cool.
And his stuff's so good. I think I told him, like, in the middle of the process, I'm like, I want to comic book marry you. I want to do comics with you forever. Because high quality work. Yeah, it's high quality work and fast. Like, it's just, it's unheard of in the comic book industry. There's so few people that can produce a monthly comic.
I just know, like going into comics, like, just stressing over deadlines. So, like, if you got to make it, like, you got to just be good enough to meet those deadlines. So, yeah, just trying to reach a style where I can still be expedient, but still, it will still look good enough.
How?
Yeah, there's the freelancer motto. Like, you have to be the two of the three things to succeed. You know, you have to be, you know, a good personable person. You have to be really good at the work, or you have to be fast. And it's two of the three, right? But Jason's all three, which makes me very suspicious of him. Like, there's got to be. Like, what's the catch?
I thought you were going to say, like, I was going to say, which one am I missing, Chip?
I was thinking, like, I'm missing good art. Like, I think I'm personable enough and I'm fast, but yeah, my stuff's not that good. So Jason's beat.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel the same way, but yeah, we're all each other's critics.
Yeah, I am my own worst critic.
Yeah, but that's how you get better, right? Like,
exactly.
There are artists who I won't name, but that kind of hit a point where their fans told them how great they were, and they believed it, and then they coasted, and they just never got better. And some cases would get worse, and you're just like, oh, you don't want to end up being that person. You don't want to be so down on yourself that you hate everything you do. But you can't, if you love every page that you've done, you're done.
Yeah.
Like, you're done as an artist getting better. That's the unfortunate thing.
Yeah. And I think that definitely applies to any kind of art, whether you make music or you act or you do comic art or you write. You can never fall in love with yourself too much.
Jason, did you have this, like, when you went to Sheridan, where, because we both went to, was it Sheridan or OCAD?
Sheridan for
illustration. So we both went to school for illustration. I remember in first year, there would always be like one or two students who usually came from another art program who were just cocky as hell, and would argue with the teacher every time the teacher gave them criticism, and they, you know, try and back it up, like, well, you know, I learned this from so-and-so, and this is how I do my work. And you would look at their work and you're like, oh, it is pretty good. But then they never got better. Like, by year three or year four, it's like, oh, yeah, no, they suck because they've just been doing the same thing over and over again, and they never got better. Did you have that?
Yeah, I think there were a few. And, like, yeah, they're definitely not doing illustration work anymore what I've seen on Facebook. But, yeah, like, I think there was, like, a point in my career, like, I almost thought the same way until, like, I got to do some apprenticeship with this. I'm not going to say his name, but, like, he was like a former Marvel editor, and he was so rough on my work to the point where, like, I was on the fence about continuing doing comics. Like, I had trouble sleeping, going like, well, what am I going to do now? Like, I always wanted to do comics, but now I suck. But then it took me like 3 days to, like, just suck it up and take all that criticism and just work on it. And, like, he was definitely right. Like, just don't look for praises. Look for all the things that will make you better, and just work at that. So,
I
showed him, like a book that was, like, 150 pages, and he didn't like it. And I just had to redraw those 150 pages. Because I was not happy with
it. It's so painful. I had a thing where my first year out of school, I was doing pretty well. Like, I was being published in newspapers, and again, I got a little cocky, and I secured a portfolio showing with the art director of a very illustrious Canadian magazine. And I was like, oh, this is it. Like, I'm going to get in there and I'm going to make all this money. It's going to be amazing. And I went in there with my portfolio, physical portfolio, and showed this woman my pieces. And she was just kind of critiquing, like, some choices I was making. I'm like, oh, you know, I started to explain why I was doing it. Like, oh, you know, I did all these in black and white because, you know, the newspaper I worked for requested them. She's like, well, yeah, but we're not black and white. So, okay, all right. And then she got to a piece and she just pointed at it and said, if you can't paint hands, don't put them in your portfolio. And then it just kept flipping. And I just like, I remember just sitting there being like, oh my God. And she finished. She was unimpressed. She gave me the portfolio. I walked outside. I stood on the street corner, just stunned. And I opened my portfolio, took the piece out with the bad hand, and I just threw it in the garbage. Because I was like, she was right. Yeah. She was 100% right.
Yeah,
and I, you just think you're going to get away with it. Like, it's kind of whatever. But she won't notice. Oh, she noticed and just dragged me over the coals. And but yeah, it was the right call. And I think it made me a better artist for sure. Ugh,
I remember one thing pain. That that former editor senpai said to me. He asked me, did you go to art school? And like I graduated from Sheridan. It's like, yeah, I did. And it's like, doesn't look like it. And
Ow.
Yeah, he was definitely right, because I did not apply everything I learned into the comic. Like, of course, like all those weeks of doing life drawing and object drawing, like that has to apply in comics.
Yeah.
Damn though, jeez.
Yeah.
That's harsh. Now, when you guys meet people at Comic Cons and they kind of want to show you their work, how do you critique them?
Well, for me, I mean, I learned this trick from my dad. People call it a different thing, but he told me when he would have to critique his employees at his office, he would give them the shit sandwich, which is the criticism, compliment, criticism. Or no, compliment, criticism, compliment. So you start off, you're just like, oh, wow, like, you know, those real dynamic figures. Their character's abs can't be on their shoulder. I don't know, whatever, like something really bad. And then you're like, oh, I really love the energy in these pages. So you always make sure you couch it, unless they're like so far gone. I find it very hard to critique a portfolio when everything's wrong, because like you don't really know where to start or end. So you basically just have to be like, yeah, you know, just keep going. You gotta just make everything better, you know, just take this and make it better. It's hard because I find at comic conventions, especially, someone shows you their portfolio and they've got the thing that I had when I went to the art director. In the back of their mind, they're just like, this is it, my big break.
Yeah.
He's gonna look at it and be like, those are the best muscles I've ever seen. But then usually what happens is the pages are super detailed, but there's no storytelling. Like, they just want to do pin-up shots. Like, a lot of people want to be a comic artist because they like the idea of it, but they actually don't want to be a comic artist. Like, they don't want to tell stories, and they don't want to draw a page a day, you know, really give their all. And that's, you know, that can be a little heartbreaking, and you have to be pretty gentle with those kind of critiques, because you can usually tell based on the person in front of you and the type of work they're showing, like where they're at in their head. So yeah, I don't know. Do you review a lot of work, Jason?
Yeah, once in a while, like someone would show me their portfolio, and you know, it really depends on like their age. Like if they're a teenager, like you definitely want to tell them their strengths and it's just give them more encouragement and maybe just one or two things that you need to work on, and that's about it. But when it comes to like someone that's much older that thinks that they're ready to work for the big companies, I give them the option. I'll be pretty friendly about it. Like, I'll, you know, compliment their stuff, but then I would ask him, do you want me to be really honest? Like, really, really honest? and I learned this from, like, you know, that former editor that influenced me. Heck, I'll just say his name. I mean, because he's been a great positive influence, so I'm just gonna have to thank Larry Hama.
Yeah, that's awesome.
He's been like really like as he was like very rough with like with his criticism. Like I like that's the only way you got to learn. And so yeah, that's I'll just be given those harsh critiques.
So when you ask somebody, do you want me to be brutally honest or whatever, how many people say no?
Maybe about 2 out of 5.
Really? Yeah. Wow. That's such a weird kind of self-awareness. Like, it's almost like their unconscious just went, no, don't, you don't want to hear this. Like, you know you're not ready. Don't do this. What are you doing?
You can't like protect yourself like that because, you know, sooner or later someone is going to be brutal whether you want it or not. And I think it's like you said, if, you know, if you just coast on your own, you know, perceived greatness, you're going to just hit a wall eventually. And
yeah,
be willing to just push yourself and learn and be told that your stuff sucks.
Yeah.
Because
it's like, I find it's even hard, like writing at Marvel. Sometimes I get paired with relatively new artists, and because they're working for Marvel, I think in the back of their head, they're like, oh, I made it. And then all of a sudden they get like a 5,000 word notes from me on their layouts and anatomy. And I'm just like, look, I'm just going to tell you there's some problems here. And this is why I'm telling you this. And like, knock on wood, so far I haven't had anyone quit a book over it or get upset with me. Like, I think for the most part, they see where the issues are and like, oh, okay. But like, it doesn't stop. Like, that's the thing. Even once you hit Marvel or DC or Image, like you're still constantly learning.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think just because you make it to, you know, the quote unquote big leagues, that doesn't mean necessarily that you can't be kicked out of those big leagues.
Yeah. Yeah. In some cases, like, you know, I sent emails to people working on books for Marvel who are like usually fucking up, like either with the quality of the work or deadlines. And I just basically tell them like, you're about to blow your job at Marvel, like, and you need to know this. And the editors are being kind about it, but you're about to be fired, so you got to step up. And like, it happens a fair amount where you're just like, oh, okay, like, just because you're here doesn't mean you get to stay here, and you got to make sure that you're producing quality and doing it on time. Yeah, because it's a hard industry. Like, you know, most jobs, you get a job and like you have to kind of really fuck up to get fired. But with comics, you can do everything right and still not get work. Like, the industry is littered with people who did really quality stuff that just stopped getting jobs. So yeah, you kind of have to really give it your all, more so than most industries, I think.
Now, I know that the industry has changed a lot, of course, with the advent of all like the digital mediums. Has it made it any easier or harder to get your work seen or to get your work published?
I mean, there's no barrier to entry. Like, if you want people to see your work, you can put it online on a variety of platforms. You know, Jason and I, we self-published physical copies back in the day, which takes a bit more initiative, I think, because you actually have to source out the printer and send it to the distributor and kind of make some deals and promote it at the same time. So
yeah,
there's no barrier to entry. There's probably more people that are there to take advantage of you, which is the unfortunate side effect. Because you are putting it online, everyone can see it, and everyone has their own kind of, you know, shady business dealings and can more easily take advantage of young up-and-coming creators. But the smart creators are like, no, like, you could just do it yourself, and you can build up your own career online without having to rely on publishers necessarily.
What do you say are some of the signs of those, like, shady deals that people should be, like, watching out for?
Taking all the rights. For sure, not showing you the accounting on the books. We're in a really good position with Comixology, because they pay well, they pay on time. There's no interference on the editorial level, and yeah, it's very straightforward. And we retain the copyright on the work. They get publishing rights for X number of years, and that's it. We own it. So in 4 years' time, if we want to publish it elsewhere, we can do that with it. So we're lucky there. I'm lucky with Image because it's basically an artist co-op. Like, you own everything. You see a full, sometimes too much, you see the full accounting of everything sold. Like, I know every bit of minutia as to where the money is gone. But then there'd be some publishers that won't let you know, or that will hold on to your royalties, and like, you have to be aggressive with them to get paid. And yeah, they
don't even honor contract agreements too. So
yeah. just because you got it in writing doesn't necessarily mean things are going to happen. So yeah, there's always going to be shitty people that'll take advantage. They'll take advantage of people with a passion and a desire to break into an industry. But yeah, you don't really need to sign up with the publishers anymore. If you do it yourself, like, you'll get noticed. You can do it elsewhere with good word of mouth. Because that's the big thing. Like, we all know who the shitty people are.
Yeah.
For the most part, like, once you do it long enough, like, I know there's like, yeah, there's several companies like I will never work for. I just won't. Either because of the people there or because of the practices of the companies. And if I see a friend about to work for them, I will send them a message saying, don't do this. Trust me. Yeah, because you have to look out for each other. Unless I hate the person, then I'm just like, oh, great. Yeah,
fine. Good luck.
Yeah. All the best. Have fun, buddy. Enjoy. I want to talk a bit about the story behind this thing. We already talked about how this thing kind of kicked off, but I want to ask about your vision of the afterlife, because one of the things that gets mentioned is that the afterlife is not one set thing. It is, in the words of one of the characters, life beyond is a collision of ideas and places. I love that line, because I personally think that no religion has it right. When it came to sort of devising how it was going to look like, what it was going to be happening there, how'd you go about doing that?
Yeah, so that was a very tricky part. It kind of took a while to kind of figure out. When you're dealing with a book like this, you don't want to appropriate other religions necessarily, and kind of put your stamp on them and represent them to the world. But you also don't want to just focus on one true religion, like, yeah. Because then the book feels very, very strange and unrealistic, as realistic as a book like this can get. And so I've always kind of gravitated towards the idea of, like, that the afterlife would be something where, you know, what you bring into it is what it ends up being. And that gets reflected back into the characters as well. Like, Susanna, what she brings into it, you know, is this possibly undeserved feeling of guilt. So that has to be reflected in what her afterlife is. You know, I've often said that, like, you know, the people that actually deserve to go to hell probably don't, because they don't think that they deserve. And the people that don't deserve to go do go, because they have actual guilt and responsibility and the negative feelings associated with negative actions. So yeah, I kind of wanted to play with that, and so we incorporated a few elements here and there of various religions. Originally, I did a deep dive into the concepts of the afterlife of dozens of religions, and trying to figure out how we could create one kind of perfect unified vision of an afterlife. But that seemed too convoluted and too weird to explain to the reader, and so keeping it tailored to the characters themselves felt like the easiest way forward.
And the characters, I loved all the little, like, nuances with the characters. Like, I loved the conversation that the devil has when he basically says that he hates all sides. He hates heaven, hell, everything in between. I thought that the devil probably would, actually, because he didn't ask to go to hell.
Yeah, those are my favorite versions of the devil, where it's like, well, of course he doesn't like any of this. Like, he's the devil. Like, he should fucking hate all of it. And he should especially hate the demons who are, like, vying for his spot, essentially, or, you know, for his favor. Like, it's revolting on all levels. So that felt fun, because he shows up later in the story to have that kind of reveal, almost, that he has a disdain for everyone, and he kind of just wants them to fight it out. And he wants them to suffer. He wants Janice and Susanna to suffer, but he also wants Dumu to suffer in having to get them. Yeah, that was fun to play with.
The characters as they were in the final version, was that how they started out, or do they kind of change as you went through, like, developing everything?
I think if they don't change, then there's something wrong. Like, I find that with any project, I have an idea of where the story's going to go and where the characters are going to go, but you don't really learn everything about the characters right away. You kind of have to do it as you go along. Like, I didn't land on the fates of the characters until, like, probably issue 3.
Like, all those flashbacks.
Yeah, and the flashbacks were kind of based on stuff from my past, and I knew from the outset I kind of wanted to incorporate that, but I didn't quite know how I was going to pull it off. And so the final fates of the characters really didn't kind of come to me until part way through writing issue 3. And it's the same with my Marvel stuff as well. Like, I'll have a plan for a year of stories, but I always allow myself the opportunity to change my mind on things as I go, which gets a little tricky with the Marvel stuff because sometimes things are drawn out of order. So sometimes I'll just, like, kill a character and then realize it's alive and, like, 3 issues later being drawn.
Oops.
Has happened.
Oh,
so you have to really do a lot of mechanics to kind of figure things out with those kind of storylines. Like, the nice thing about this was knowing it was 5 issues, like, it kept it really tight.
I remember when I was reading the script for issue number 3, I was like, holy smokes, this has, like, a lot of emotional weight, and I got to draw this. I felt it, like, while penciling and inking, I was like, I got to make sure, like, all the feels will translate to the reader, because, man, this is heavy.
Totally showed, yeah, the scene in the hospital was from my youth when I was, like, a teenager. I had a cousin with cystic fibrosis, and I went to visit her in the hospital, and basically exactly as Jason drew it, where everyone was around, they were kind of talking about her upcoming wedding, and she was, like, flipping through, like, a wedding catalog, but, like, you know, she had the respirator on, and, like, the back of her gown was open. I remember just watching it, and I just wanted to scream. I just wanted to, because it was just like, what are you doing? Like, everyone's just pretending at this point that she's going to make it. And, you know, she passed away a few weeks after that. And that really, the feeling of that really haunted me for years. Because, you know, when you're a teenager, you feel like that's the feeling of righteousness. Like, you're all delusional. Like, I'm the one with the answers. But then as you get older, you recognize, like, oh, no, actually, like, they're living. And they're dealing with it in probably the proper way. Like, as if there's going to be a tomorrow. I was worried, like, writing the script, like, can I get that across to Jason? Can Jason get across to me? And Jason delivered beautifully on that scene. And Paris as well on the colors. Just gorgeous work.
Oh, yeah.
For me as a reader, there are so many emotional anchors to be attached to, you know? Like, you're attached to, like, Janice and her kind of struggle with all her past regret. And there's Susanna who, you know, is going to hell for something that really wasn't even her fault. You think, oh man, she deserves, like, a second chance. Like, where, like, it's kind of like, where is the gray area in religion? Where's, like, the do-over from God?
It's pretty split. Like, obviously, like, Christianity has kind of, like, all right, you got heaven and hell, but then they introduce the idea of purgatory and limbo. And, you know, obviously other religions have, like, kind of a sliding scale as well through reincarnation. What are you going to be reincarnated as? There is gray area to be had, but, you know, it always still comes down to it's the hell of your own making.
Now, I don't want to give away any spoilers here. We are a very no spoiler kind of program. So I will just ask, the ending, was that the first ending you had?
Yeah, without spoiling it, kind of. It's hard to get into the details without spoiling it, but I knew where Janice needed to be by the end of it, but I didn't know her fate after that fate, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. until issue 3. And same with Susanna. Like, Susanna was pretty straightforward. I kind of knew where I wanted to take her. Janice was a little trickier because I felt like she needed a purpose, and so much of the story is about her kind of discovering her purpose all the way through, so it had to pay off in the end.
I was genuinely surprised by all the twists and turns. Cool. As I was going through the issues, I thought, man, I did not see any of this coming. Holy crap.
Well, it's kind of the beauty of the kind of the done in one, like the 5-issue series that, you know, isn't open for a sequel or anything like that. Like, I'm so used to it, Marvel. There's this thing that the writer Matt Fraction once said about writing for Marvel or DC, and he said it's like is like writing a constant second act, because you don't, you never have full resolution, because you can't, because the story continues beyond you. If you leave Fantastic Four or whatever, like, you don't leave with them happily ever after. Like, you just can't, because somebody else has to pick up those threads. Whereas something like Afterlift, there's a deep sense of satisfaction from the idea that this is a its own story, a complete story that has a proper arc to it and a proper ending. So you're able to do stuff like that. You're able to kind of like maybe give people twists and surprises that they're not expecting, because they're kind of conditioned to not expect those reading the Marvel and DC books. You know, where like, say, you know, Wolverine dies, but he'll be back. Don't worry.
Well, he's died like 10 times, so at this point, yeah, it's really just like a vacation for him.
Fans need a break from Wolverine.
Yeah.
maybe a little bit. And how is Peter Parker still 35 after being around since the 50s? How the hell is he still
he's 28, first
son
of all.
Bitch.
Wow.
Come on.
How?
20 after, or 27.
Brand new day or something?
There's a lot of debate, but he's 27 or 28. I think I said he's 28. I think Nick Spencer says he's 27. It's a thing.
It's a power that he has, you know.
Well, like, Franklin Richards is like really catching up to Peter Parker.
Yeah,
I know. It's a discussion I've had before at Marvel. Like, obviously, because I just did Spider-Man Life Story, which was about the character aging in real time.
That was so good. I love that story.
Oh. Cool, thanks. Because the condition with Marvel comic characters is they don't age, right? They just can't age, because then you'll have Grandpa Spider-Man in a few years. But the problem is they just keep introducing more teenagers, and I'm like, well, what the fuck are you gonna do with all these teenagers? Like at some point they gotta become adults. But like, how do you have a teenager become an adult while Peter Parker is 27? It's such a convoluted mess. They're gonna murder those teens, let me tell you.
I was just going to say that.
There's going to be a lot of teen deaths.
Just going to say, kill them all. Have
teens?
Yeah, yeah. It's like the mutant massacre, but the teen massacre.
Jeez, oh, that's dark.
No more teens. It is one of those things, like, you know, when Marvel Comics started, they had a few years where Spider-Man aged, and I think that was like the kind of revolutionary thing about that title.
Mm-hmm.
Because the readers were like, oh, he was like a 15-year-old nerd. Now he's like a college dude on a motorcycle. And he's Romita handsome. But then, you know, clearly the powers that be were like, what the fuck are we doing? Like,
whoops.
We don't want him like middle-aged with kids. Yeah.
Yeah. At some point he's going to hit like 60, huh? Shit.
Yeah, yeah. So it's created this weird kind of illusion that kind of maintains. But the more populated the universe gets, the trickier it is to suspend that disbelief.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that's why, yeah, again, like, something like this is a lot of fun to get into, because those rules kind of go out the window and you can just focus on the story itself.
Do you think at some point you might be able to go back and revisit it, maybe do a sequel or something like that?
No, not really. The smart move would be to say, oh, of course, in case like a TV show or a movie gets made of it or something. And we're like, oh, we need
to make money. The car gets its own spin-off.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. You're so good at drawing those cars.
Yeah. The Mazda show.
Yourself. The car starts talking. And
you said it yourself. The car is its own character.
I think it's been done.
But no, it's its own story. It was told completely. And I'd rather do new things with the team, like Jason and Paris, Aditya, Allison. Like, I think it's a fun idea just to go and do a new story.
Yeah.
And have people follow the creators from story to story. Mm-hmm. and to, you know, kind of rehash or exploit the previous story.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, what are you working on right now?
Maybe we are doing something together.
We will.
At that, or I don't know.
We're working on a new book together, but in this post-COVID-19 world, it's hard to tell when things can be properly announced, when things will come out, who will come out with. But yeah, there's no way that I was going to pass up a chance to kind of keep working with this team. Like, everyone was so great, so professional. Yeah, it's like a dream team. I'm the one holding them down, really. Like, I'm kind of the fuck up of the crew. But we're definitely working on something together again. And so we're
just working on a backlog of issues, so we won't be delayed once the floodgates open.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I imagine that once this does all, you know, peter out, you're going to see this explosion of new releases from, like, comic creators and writers and musicians, because they're just home working on, like, new stuff right now.
Yeah, which is another thing to consider, like, when everyone else is releasing a new thing, do you pace it out? You know, some people are going straight to digital. You know, I think Comixology themselves are going to be putting out a lot more kind of new titles during this period. Mm-hmm. You know, Ed Breaker and Marcos Martin published a panel Syndicate Friday, which is gorgeous. So people are looking at different avenues to release things before, say, comic shops are open again. Mm-hmm. But I think with something like this, like Jason's right, like we just kind of want to bank issues and get a nice backlog and take this time to kind of just get ahead, mm-hmm. and, you know, pray there's an industry to accept it.
Fingers crossed. It's going to be there. It'll be.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how it's going to look, but.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's clearly going to be a different beast than what it was before all this. Mm-hmm. And we just have to kind of prepare for that. But as long as you produce good work, I think it'll still sell. It'll still stand above the rest. Mm-hmm. So hopefully we're doing that.
Chip, Jason, thank you both so much for joining me. I really appreciate this. But before we go, where do folks go to learn more about you? Throw out your websites, your socials.
Follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Rebel_Lou, because I'm a big Star Wars fan. They can follow my Facebook page, The Pitiful Human Lizard, though the series has ended. Not many updates for a while, but we'll wait and see.
And as for me, just don't bother. You don't need any of this. I don't need any of that. If you need to find me, you'll find me.
Something.
I'm so bad at promotion. Whatever.
Like Onward on Disney Plus or something.
Oh, yeah. Check out Onward on Disney Plus. I'm really proud of it. Yeah, I don't know. We'll check out Afterlift on Comixology.
There you go. It's an amazing series. Great art, great story. You'll definitely love it. And definitely get Comixology. $5.99 a month. You get access to 25,000 plus titles from all the major players, manga, indie stuff. It's a great resource. I am way too deep into it. I'll never come back. Awesome. But once again, guys, thank you so much. Look forward to talking to you for the next project.
Awesome. Thanks.
Yes. Thank you.